about to pick up once again with the last week in the life of Jesus. We can mark off this next section as a large one, all revolving about temple activities. And it extends from Luke 19, verse 45 through 22:6. And if you look at that block of text in your Bible, you can see that that incorporates a good deal of material. Now, before we settle in on that, let's do some of the preliminaries. And we will simply outline Luke 19, 45 through 48 as the preliminaries to this week of teaching in the temple. 19, 45 through 48. Now here's what happens. Sunday, the Lord comes in with the triumphal entry. We've already studied that in chapter 19, verse 28. The one thing that Luke does not tell us, that Mark tells us, is that when Jesus came in with the triumphal entry, and if you let your eye go down to chapter 19, verse 37, 38 of 19, as he was approaching, near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the miracles which they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest." And then Luke picks up with the Pharisees being upset and says, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." And he answered, "I tell you, if these became silent, the stones would cry out." Then, as he approaches the city, he cries over the city, and we had that prophecy, we spent three times with it, about the six future indicative verbs telling what is going to happen to Jerusalem, and we emphasize the fulfillment of that prophecy. That same evening, now in verse 45, it says, "And he entered the temple." And we ought to intersperse something before that, because verse 45 apparently picks up the next morning on Monday, the remarks about the fall of Jerusalem were followed that evening by his first entry into the temple. Go back to Mark 11. Mark 11. Luke, as we come to the end of the triumphal entry day, Luke records the prophecy of Jerusalem's fall. Mark doesn't. Mark notes that something else happened, and that is in chapter 11, verse 11. Notice verse 10, the words spoken at the triumphal entry, and then verse 11, he entered Jerusalem. And Mark or Luke will say he cried over the city. He made the prediction of the fall of the city. All that is entered in at this point. But notice, Mark skips that. And Mark simply says he entered the Jerusalem, came to the temple, after looking all around, departed for Bethany with the 12, since it was already late. So late Sunday evening, he comes to the city. Luke says he made the prophecy about the fall of the city. He wept over the city. And that's where Luke stops. Mark does not record that. Mark just says he came in, he went to the temple, looked around, a quick visit, and then he went back out to Bethany, and he stayed there for the night. Now, with that, let's go back then to Luke 19. And notice that verses 45 through 48 will focus on two points. One is the cleansing out of the temple. The cleansing out of the temple. And that will be the focal point in 19, 45, and 46. Then the next emphasis will be the teaching in the temple. But cleansing out will be the first key word, 45 and 46. Teaching in will be the second. One word, however, about ancient and certainly biblical history. Whenever we think about history, we think of chronology. That is our way of thinking. We think chronology. In other words, it's the job of a historian to set down events as they occurred in chronological time sequence. That is our mode of thinking. However, if you move back not only to the New Testament, but back to documents further than that, or historical documents, historians didn't always think time. In English, the way we think, we always think, when did that happen? Now, did this occur before this? Or did this occur after this? What's the time sequence? We're always interested in time. Many ancient histories are not interested in time. They're interested in topic. Now, what I mean is this. Let me gather up 1, 2, 3 pens here. This is a time period of 10 years. Event, event, event. And I put these in chronological order. This happened in, say, 5 BC or 5 AD. This in 10 AD. And this in 40 AD. Our view of history would say, be sure you get them in order. Be sure the one that happened first is discussed first. The one that happened second is discussed second. The one that happened third is discussed third. Chronology is what we're interested in. Now, you got to make a leap the minute you move out of our type of recording history into ancient history. They many times did not care that this happened before this. What they cared about was this. You have a series of events, and they all revolve about the same subject, about the same topic. And therefore, if they want to look down the chronology, and they will see an economic upheaval, another economic upheaval, another one, with all kinds of stuff in between, they might take this economic upheaval, this one, and this one, that happened in different years, and narrate them like that. And you say, well, did that one happen before the other, or did the other happen before the other? They don't care. That's not the point. The point is topic. And therefore, when you come to something like what we've just seen, you've got a good illustration of it, because Luke, when he looks at the event, and let's put Mark here, Luke here. They both look at the triumphal entry. Mark says, I want to record that in my book. It's important to me. Luke says, Mark, I agree with you. That's important for my purpose also. And they both record it. And Mark looks at Jesus weeping over the city. He looks at Jesus making the prophecy. And Mark says, well, you know, for the purpose of my book, I think I'll just let that aside. I'm not going to use it. I'll set it aside. Luke says, well, you know, for me, and for what I want to accomplish by my gospel, I'm going to include it. And I will put these historical events here, so that you may have Luke, both of them come together here at the same time, triumphal entry, and Luke will say, let me add this whole body of extra stuff. And Mark will say, well, I'll be satisfied to say, he went in, looked around, went back to Bethany. That's all I'm going to say. The next morning, Luke picks up immediately with the cleansing of the temple. Mark comes along and said, you know, on the way back from Bethany, something happened, and I'm going to include that in my book, and he includes it. And therefore, you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, each one writing from his own perspective. I think we've illustrated it this way. Let's take the life of Eisenhower. And let's see, we'll take people. Lee Wilhite, you're an author. Jane is an authoress. Bernie, you also are. And here is a pile of information that we have about Eisenhower. Bernie, your assignment is to write a book that shows he was a great military figure. Lee, your object is to write a book showing that he was really a good father to his children. And Jane, you're going to specialize, I don't know whether he had one, I assume he did, you're going to specialize on his hobbies. Out of this big pile of material, what are each one of them going to do? They're going to get in there and they're going to start piecing it out, and they're going to say, well, that hasn't, I mean, here's this particular campaign he was in, and Jane would say, that has nothing to do with a hobby, so I'm not going to use that, I'll set it aside. But over here, maybe a little incident about one evening before he went into campaign, he was knitting a cardigan sweater. And you take it, well, that probably wasn't his life's work, but that is an interesting bit of trivia. And therefore you record it because it showed a little bit about what his hobbies were, what his extra interests were. And therefore you put the two books together, or the three books. And Bernie, what were you going to do? Okay, you're going to do the military. So you put in the campaigns. Lee, you're going to do what? Oh, something about his children. Something about his children. Whose book would you expect to have perhaps someone dug into this pile over here and they pulled out a lot of quotes from his kids? Which one of the three would be doing that? Lee'd be doing it, wouldn't he? You don't find that in Jane's book that has him knitting, or in Bernie's book that has him fighting a campaign, and therefore the three books are contradictory. Make any sense? Of course they're not. Each author had his intent, and he came at it, took out of the large body of facts for his intents and purposes. Now, while we're on that particular point, let's go to one other that says that's exactly what he did, and I'm going to paraphrase him. He's going to say, I had a whole pile. I went to the pile, and looking at the pile, I took out of the pile things that proved 2 points. John 20. John 20. John is looking back over his shoulder on the book he has written. And he says, many other signs. Signs is a word often used for miracles. Therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. Now, have I paraphrased it okay? I had a whole pile, big pile, lots of events, lots of miracles. I picked this one, put it in my book. I picked this one and put it in my book. I put this one and put it in my book. And when my book was all finished, there was still a big pile. I didn't run out of facts. I didn't run out of information. There was still a lot there. But my little pile, taken out of the big pile, suited the purpose of my book. And notice verse 31. He tells us why he picked out of the pile the facts that he picked out of the pile. He says, these miracles or signs have been written for what reason? That you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life through his name. Wouldn't you say that John, maybe this expression will help you, took the pile of facts and wrote his book through a filter, and he tested every one of the facts to say, does that really say something about Jesus as the Messiah? Does that really say something about Jesus as the Son of God? And he filtered them to get his particular book. I say all of that because that perspective is often lost. And if you are locked into everything must be in chronological order, you might as well take Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and dump them in the trash. Because many times getting the chronology is hard. Because many of your ancient historians say, I take it that my readers will not be such blockheads that I will have to tell them I'm not doing everything in chronological order. I assume that they may understand that I'm doing a topical order and will read with reference to that particular type thing. We are so time-oriented. And the minute you come to the Bible, you really have to give that up, especially when you find an entire Old Testament written in the Hebrew language that has no tense. And when I talk about tense for English reader, what are you doing in your mind? Past, present, future. Past, present, future. Tense is time. It's is, it was, it shall be. And we go through school conjugating verbs with reference to what? Time. Over and over, it's time. Was it past? Was it present? Was it future? Something is present tense. It's not past tense. The is verb fixes it in present. Was fixes it in past. Shall be fixes it in future. And we live that way. Hebrew has no tense. And therefore, the English reader comes lumbering into the Old Testament and falls all over himself. Come to the New Testament written in Greek. And we've been over this, and you could say this before I say it. Tense in Greek is not time. It's kind of action. Is it going on? Or what is the kind of action involved in? And time is secondary. So this is where you got to make some real mental adjustments to get into the thing in a proper way. So back now to Luke 19. See, we've been gone from that so long. Was that where we started? Luke 19. Okay, you have then the cleansing out of the temple. We said a little bit about the way ancient history is put together. And now number two. The entry was not arbitrary. The entry was prophesied. The entry was not arbitrary, it was prophesied. And I'll put under prophesied, arbitrary. And by arbitrary, I simply mean, as he came in, he said, well, it would be a nice thing to do to go into the temple and look around a little bit while we're here. We don't get down to Jerusalem very often. The teaching was in Galilee. And since we happen to be here, let's go ahead, guys. We've got time enough before dark. Let's take a little tour of the temple so we'll be sure to be able to say, we've been there, we entered in. And it's not the fulfillment of a plan. I don't have to do it. I could go in, I could not. That's what I mean by arbitrary. He could do it, he could not do it. It didn't make any difference. It was not arbitrary. It was prophesied. Go to Malachi, last book of the Old Testament, chapter 3 and verse 1 and 2. Even though that may be a book you haven't been to, it shouldn't be hard to find if you can find Matthew. Just go Matthew and then one left. One block left. To chapter 3. Malachi says, behold, I'm going to send my messenger. The word my messenger is the English translation of the book. The book is Malachi, and M-A-L-A-C. Malach means angel or messenger. The E on the end, or the I on the end, is the Hebrew possessive pronoun meaning my. So you can take in your I and go from my messenger right up to the title of the book, Malachi. And as we've said previously, humorously, it is Malachi, not Malachi. It's not a book written by an Italian prophet named Malachi. This is Malachi, meaning my messenger. Behold, I'm going to send Malachi, if you're going to pronounce it per Hebrew or as Hebrew. I'm going to send my messenger, Jehovah sending, speaking, and he will clear the way before me. Reference to John the Baptist. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. And the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. So verse 1 is simply going to say that we will state the fact. The Lord is going to come to his temple. States the fact. Verse 2 goes a little further. Who can endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? for he's like a refiner's fire and a fuller's soap. Does it sound a little bit like when he comes, he's going to clean up the joint and they're not going to like it? Who can stand it? So, the second states his purpose, and it also states the response. Perfect fulfillment in the New Testament books. Jesus does enter the temple. That's a fact. He did go in with a purpose on two times. Once at the beginning of his ministry, once at the end. And in each case, he cleans the place up. He throws over the money changers table, or I've said previously, he tumps them over. I forgot to look up whether tump is a word. Is it a word in your vocab? You ever tumped anything over? Mary, you never tumped anything over? No kidding. Really? How many have tumped things over? You know what I mean by tump, don't you? Okay, maybe it's not even a word, I don't know, but it is, I think, in most people. He tumps over the tables, the money goes all over the place, he takes the scourge of cords, he sends out the money changers, the cattle and everything is all over the place, and he certainly does a clean-up job in the temple, as Malachi prophesied he does. And what was the response to it? The response to it, at first on the part of the leaders, was they took it. And as we get into chapter 20 today, we'll find that the only reason they took it is because they were scared to death of the people who liked him, and they didn't want to get stoned to death. So they took it. But they are going to come on the next day, the Tuesday after this event of cleaning out the temple in chapter 19. They will come in the next morning, and they will say, "By whose authority did you do this?" And the Lord will answer them an interesting way with a question, and we'll find out that the only reason they did not act and do something is they were afraid that the people would stone them to death. And so we've got an emotional setting that comes into the picture. So the entry then was prophesied. So let's go back now to Luke 19 out of Malachi. And note one other thing. There were two such entries. And this is just sort of parenthetical in your notes. The first entry was at the opening of his ministry. And if you want to read about that, you would look at John chapter 2, 13 through 25. There was a second entry at the close of his ministry. And for that, it's the passage we are looking at, which is Luke 19, 45 and 46. Or if you want to go to a parallel, I think it's Mark that gives much fuller account of all the things that happened in that particular entry. We're down to the second one. So notice then, chapter 19, verse 45. And he entered the temple and began to cast out those that were selling. Now the first thing to say about that is when he entered the temple, that is about as broad a statement as you could possibly make. That would be roughly equivalent in terms of its parts to say he entered Missouri. There are any number of places within Missouri that you can enter. You could go to Jefferson City. You could go to Joplin. You could go to St. Louis. You could go to Kansas City. You could go to Columbia. You could go to any Kirksville. You could go to any number of places in terms of your entry into Missouri. That's a big, broad brush. Well, when it says Jesus entered the temple, for us, if we interpret temple the way we understand it today, it's a pretty narrow thing. There are churches in Kansas City, for whatever reason, that are called such and such temple. And if you say he went to such and such temple, there's not a big distinction as to whether they went into the auditorium, the kitchen, or the bathroom. Not a big deal. However, the temple we need to understand, and I'll try to diagram it as best I can. And let's begin by making a large sort of a triangular, a sort of a rectangular structure, like this. And then around this whole square, I'll make another smaller square within it. This is going to be the temple. And as you move inward, you come into the more holy place. And I'll square it out right now, and we'll do something with it later. In dividing it. Now, this whole thing was called the temple. Hieron. In Greek. Hieron included everything. There was a very special place right here that was taken off the Old Testament tabernacle. Do you remember the holy place? The Holy of Holies was the place of God's dwelling. And it was called something different. And I'll draw an arrow out from it. It was called the Naas. The Naas was the dwelling place in the Old Testament tabernacle of God Himself. Nobody went in to the Naas. Nobody. Out here, at this point, you came into a place here that was called Israel's court. It was had little semicircular steps leading up to it. Out here was the court of women. And out here was the court of Gentiles. Right in here, at the bottom of these steps, around these steps, was a sign. And the sign said that whoever went beyond this point, besides a male Jew, was dead. The Roman government did not allow Israel as a subject nation to execute the death sentence. That's one of the problems we'll get into in a little bit. They want to crucify Jesus. And they have on their books capital offense, which was death by stoning. They want to execute it, but they can't. Because Rome said you can't. And therefore, that's why they have to take him to Pilate. So that Pilate, as a Roman governor, can execute the death sentence and they can kill him as they wanted to do. But that was one of the problems that they're facing in this last week of the life of Jesus. How are we going to capture him, number one, without the people killing us? And number two, once we get hold of him, we can't put him to death. Oh, our law says we can, but we're under Rome. And Rome says you can't. So now what are we going to do? Well, they worked the deal with Judas to betray him, and then they finally run him through the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court. Then they turn him over to Pilate, and Pilate says, why are you turning him over to me? Why don't you judge him according to your law? And they say, we can't judge him according to our law because he's a malefactor, a continual criminal, it would be the paraphrase of that, and we can't put him to death. And therefore, Pilate understands you're giving over to the Romans because you want him put to death, right? And that goes on until he is finally put to death. But nonetheless, the Romans would not allow the execution of the capital punishment. It just wasn't allowed, except that sign. And if someone crossed over out of this court into the priestly area, or Israel's court, as a Gentile, they could execute on the spot. No Roman permission. Some of your secular histories give how the Roman emperors, in deference to the strong religious feelings of the Jews, allowed them to do just that, but it was an exception. Very unusual. Incidentally, about 1935 or 39, I forget which, 1935-39, they did find a stone which is preserved today that was about this particular area, and in the language of the times, it explains how that if you pass over here, it perhaps came from the temple area, one of the stones overthrown, and it forbid interest into this particular area. So when you talk about entering the temple, you got to think, it's simply, let's make this room a temple. And say there's a 10-foot square in the middle, and if anybody sets foot inside of it, they're shot on sight. Well, that's a little bit different than just being able to wander into a building and go from room to room as you chose. None of that occurred as far as the temple was concerned. Now, let's move out from that center part again to this area all around here, which was called the porch. Basilica Stoa. And the porch went all around. It was a colonnade. It was pillared. And around this, the porch, you had, for example, coming into the temple area right up here. You had the Golden Gate entry into the temple. If you go down this side of it, it was called Solomon's Porch. Any Gentile could come in here through these particular gates. Let's put one here. Remember the Gate Beautiful? That was right here. The beautiful gate. So that anybody could come out here on the porch. Anybody could come into the court of the Gentiles. Jewish women could enter the beautiful gate and come into the court of the women. And the men could move into Israel's court. But it was strict segregation. Women could not go here. Gentiles could not go here. This was really temple proper right here. But they could go all about it. And therefore, as you can... the priests, incidentally, the priests, need to divide this thing again. The priests of Israel could go in here. So this is a busy place all the time. All the courts, all of the courses of the priests of Israel were in here. They would keep the brazen altar lit. They would make the continual sacrifices. They would make the daily sacrifices. They would perform on the Day of Atonement. And you had literally hundreds of priests that were working in this area all the time, day and night. You had hours of prayer, three of them. When, if you were a Gentile proselyte, you could come in here and pray, but you couldn't go outside of this territory. If you were Jewish, during the hours of prayer, you would come to the temple and pray because they felt that prayer had particular impetus if at the temple. Three times a year, every male Jew from 12 up in all of Palestine came to this point. And by the way, in this last week, we are at the day of Passover. Jerusalem had, by estimate, if you look at the population of Israel at that time, had between 2 and 4 million people crammed into the city. It was busy. And out here, if you wanted to do some teaching, you can always go up to the temple. Just keep in mind, everybody tried to do everything they did at the temple. I mean, this was the local car wash. Or this was the... We don't even have anything parallel to it, do we? Where would you go to pray? To hold forth on your favorite issue? Can you imagine taking all the protest groups, the anti-abortion groups, the pro-abortion groups, the guy on the corner that's been there for 40 years holding forth on the anti-godliness of short sleeves? All of this, if you're a beggar, and begging was big business, good business, we think of poor beggar sitting there with his tin cup, getting a few quarters, a beggar. In fact, one of the beggars that were healed by Jesus was very reluctant to leave it. I mean, it's good business. And so you can scatter a few beggars in here if you want that have been there for years You've got all the people coming up to pray, and you have a real hodgepodge of activity. Well, let's take a look at an incident. I think I can find it. Acts 3. Just to set the scene. Oh, we got to throw one other thing in. Got to do one other thing. Out here in the court of the Gentiles, the high priest sold concessions. If you were Jewish, you had to bring an animal sacrifice. Now, when we mention temple, everybody gets real pious and thinks pious. But can you? Yeah, you guys are good at that. Can you think secular for a minute? Everybody's got to bring an animal. It's really awkward to bring a lamb from Galilee. What do you carry him in? Do you get a little pet container and like they put on airplanes and stow it someplace on the mule? Impractical. Therefore, have you got a Jewish mind? If I could get at the temple a little hot dog stand, only it's not a hot dog stand, it's a lamb stand, and I could sell to these pilgrims their animal, I could have a nice little business. Because it would be like selling hot dogs at the ballpark. Or have you ever bought a hot dog in a O'Hare or Logan Airport or JFK? What do you pay for it? $7.50. But you're caught, aren't you? I'd do it. Last time in Boston, coming through Logan, I thought, well, I'll just walk outside and look around, see if there's a McDonald's in sight, and guess what? They're not in sight. Of course, a taxi will take you to one for $20, and then you've got a $25 hamburger instead of a $5 one. But nonetheless, when you get isolated, people are at your mercy, are they not, as far as selling is concerned? Well, this was really big business. And a lamb that would cost you $5 up in Galilee would cost you $50 if you bought it down the temple. But it was basically worth it than to try to lug the lamb along all the way. So the leaders of the temple had sold concessions to certain ones for a good price in exchange for, oh no, they were priests. Caiaphas wouldn't want to make off of that, would he? No. Just set up your little stand. You're welcome to have this spot over here. I don't want anything for it. You go ahead and sell the lamb, and it's a concession to the people, and it's a nice thing. No, no. Caiaphas, Annas, all the high priests knew, hey, there's cash. So whatever you get at your concession stand, you can keep the concession stand for a kickback to me. And that was the way the whole thing. Now can you see, when Jesus comes in, and he would come into this area right here. By the way, Jesus never once entered the Naas. Never, never, never did Jesus ever go here. And here was the place where God had, in the Old Testament, where he abode. But remember, as Israel sinned, God had announced something about his presence in the temple. I-C-H-A, you finish it? B-O-D, Ichabod. Chavod is the Hebrew word for glory. And Ichabod is the word that means the glory has departed. And as the Old Testament closed, this was Ichabod. The glory had departed. The Lord's presence was no longer there. And God was not here. Does it make any sense that the God-man never entered the Naas? Because of the sin of the people, and therefore he never enters into this particular place here, but comes in at a different place. Real quick before we leave it, and we'll wrap up at this point. Acts 3. And I hope you can get the scene a little bit better now. Peter and John were going up to the temple at the ninth hour, the hour of prayer. And notice who was there. It says, a certain man who had been lame from his mother's womb was being carried along, whom they used to set down every day at the temple, which is called Beautiful. So he was out at the Beautiful Gate. That means as you came into the temple, you came up the porch, you came into the court of Gentiles, and this man was right here at the Gate Beautiful. That was a good location, because at the Gate Beautiful was where the Jewish people entered in to their court. And one of the means of salvation and forgiveness was alms. And therefore, beggars were smart. They said, when this Jewish couple comes up right here, we know that they're coming to pray, and we know what they got in mind. They want an in with God, and they want forgiveness. And therefore, I put my hand out, and it's such a natural. As you're ready to step over the door, you put your money, and you go. So it was a perfect place from which to do that. And therefore, the narrative continues by saying, when Peter and John, verse 3, were about to go into the temple, that's that gate right here, into the temple, he began asking to receive alms. And Peter, along with John, fixed his gaze upon him and said, look at us. And he began to give them this attention, expecting to receive something from them. And Peter said, I do not possess silver and gold, but whatever I have, I give to you. And he heals the man and he walks. And as he is healed at that particular type, at that moment, verse 8, you have a dramatic thing happen. Now keep in mind, this was really busy. And is this man who's been there and people are passing him by, they've passed him by for years and years and years and years, and he is healed. And the Greek words used here are so forceful, because it says Peter takes him by the hand, his ankles were strangled, and with a leap he stood upright and began to walk, walking all over the place, and entered the temple with it, walking and leaping and praising God. And so with everything pretty much routine, here is this guy that's been here for years, and here are the priests going about their serious work, and here is this idiot leaping all over the place. I'm walking. And he's jumping all over this place in here, and it gets attention. And as it gets attention, what happens? Verse 9, all the people saw him walking and praising God, and they were taking note of him as being the one who used to sit at the beautiful gate of the temple to beg alms, and they were filled with wonder and amazement at what he had done. And while he was clinging to Peter and John, all the people ran together to them. They all mass about the man and about Peter and John, and they go out to the so-called portico of Solomon, full of amazement. And as they leave this area, pour out from the beautiful gate, leave the area of the temple of the Gentiles, and they all gather out here in the portico of Solomon, and Peter begins to preach his message. Well, and we got to stop. Word comes in to the temple, and you had temple police in here to keep order. The word comes to the temple police. They come out, and you have the first arrest of the apostles for preaching out here in the portico. And for the first time in chapter 4, as they were speaking to the people, the priests, the captain of the temple guard, the Sadducees came upon them, being greatly disturbed that they were teaching the people, proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection from the dead. They laid hands on them, put them in jail the next day, for it was already evening. And you start the very exciting narrative of the book of Acts and the preaching of the apostles and all of the hustle and bustle of activity. Well, we're now going to see Jesus in chapter 19 come into this place, and as everything is nice and orderly, the concessions have been there for years, he comes in, and I don't know whether you can endure this picture of Jesus or not, but his neck is red. He is mad. And where the cattle have been released, the cords are on the floor, he takes the cords, and he begins whipping the money changers. And as he does so, he kicks the tables over, and coins and silver begin to go all over the floor. And you have pandemonium, and the temple officials, for the first time ever, looked at one another and said, this man is tearing the hell out of the temple. And they all come out, and we'll meet them next hour in Luke chapter 19, the end of the chapter. Father, we're thankful today for your word. May we understand it. May we see the scene that is set. And may we see the Son of God this Monday morning of the week in which he will die, coming into the temple, upsetting everything, and then proceeding to teach in the next 2 days, from which he will go to trial and to death, and then 3 days rise again, for which we give you thanks in his name. Amen.